Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today joined by two able minds in the sphere of politics from our Ames studio. Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, also Assistant Professor of Political Science, Jonathan Hasid, in our Ames studio. Hope you're sitting well and cozy there, Dave and Jonathan.
We are. Thanks for having us. Well, happy to be here.
Thank you for both being with us. We are going to go, well, a little later to the Iowa legislature, talk about that proposal of fast-track of about $1 billion per year in annual state taxes that's being proposed. We'll go far afield as well. We'll go to China and North Korea, get some analysis from Jonathan and Dave on those countries as well. But let's start here this hour right at home with the political aftermath continuing after the latest in a long line of school shootings that began nearly 20 years ago at Columbine High School in Colorado. Well, yesterday, House Republicans signaled they are not going to satisfy those calling for stricter gun laws. Instead, they want to focus on school security and also figuring out why law enforcement failed to act on repeated warnings about the suspects in this mass shooting at the Florida high school this month. Let's listen to House Speaker Paul Ryan explaining his frame of mind at a news conference yesterday.
We shouldn't be banning guns for law-abiding citizens. We should be focusing on making sure that citizens who should not get guns in the first place don't get those guns. And that is why we see a big breakdown in the system here. In this particular case, there were a lot of breakdowns, from local law enforcement to the FBI getting tips that they didn't follow up on to, you know, school resource officers who are trained to protect kids in these schools and who didn't do that. And that, to me, is probably the most stunning one of them all. So there's a lot that we have to look at, but what we want to do is protect people's rights while making sure that people who should not get guns do not get those guns.
Paul Ryan emphasized that the failures by the FBI and local police, as well as addressing the issue of arming teachers, he said, is a question for local governments, local school boards. But as a parent, he said he thought it was a good idea. Well, Democrat Representative Ted Deutsch of Florida, this is the district where that high school is, talked about various proposals being considered by lawmakers to deal with gun violence. This is from CBS's Face the Nation this past weekend.
The shift to arming teachers is a distraction. It's a distraction from the important discussion about all of the things that can be done right now, this week, when we go back to Washington, on mental health, on banning bump stocks, universal background checks, preventing people on the terror watch list from getting guns. Those aren't controversial. Everyone supports them. So that's what we need to focus on. But the important point here is, because of these young leaders, the ground is shifting. Members of Congress are now willing to stand up and be as offended as everyone else when the millionaire lobbyist who runs the NRA goes to a political convention and says that people like me and Congressman Mast, who want to take action to support kids, don't care about children.
Okay. Any surprises here so far? I want to get to the corporate reaction we've been seeing in the last few days as well. But as far as lawmakers right now, Dave, please go first. Any surprises here in the way the party leaders seem to be acting according to the usual playbook?
No, I don't think there's a surprise at all. This is exactly what we've seen for 20 years now, that the nation watches in horror as dozens of people are gunned down, and there are thoughts and prayers thrown to the victims. And then afterwards, the two parties disagree. The Democrats say we should do something, and the Republicans say we can't do anything. And our nation just doesn't respond. Mm-hmm. Usually we throw up some straw man argument. This year it's that we should arm teachers and that it's the FBI's fault for not preventing this tragedy. But those are silly arguments. They would not solve the problem.
Why silly?
Well, the FBI, frankly, right now continues to be underfunded and has undergone the same kind of budget cuts that the rest of the government has for the last 20 years. And no, they're not able to meet all the demands of their job. And if we want to help them to check up on every tip they get, we need to vastly increase their funding and vastly increase the ability that they have to check up on all this stuff. But that does come at the cost of liberty for the citizens of America who suddenly have a very active police state watching them.
Jonathan, take this aspect. Unlike almost all of the mass casualty shootings that have followed since Columbine, hard to believe that was nearly 20 years ago, these students, the students of Stoneman Douglas, spoke out about what happened in their school. They're demanding that politicians act. They're not taking no for an answer. Do you see that student activism had any impact, any change in this longstanding impasse between how to address gun violence in this country?
I mean, I'm hopeful. Rationally, I don't think that it'll matter too much, but I am sort of hopeful that maybe this time will be different. And we have seen, so Political and Morning Consult came out with a poll, I think this morning or yesterday, where basically it shows that for the first time, a majority of even Republicans have suddenly are in favor of more gun restrictions on particular issues. Of course, not across the board, but on particular kinds of restrictions. And this seems to have moved the needle in a way that it hasn't moved before, but I don't know how. I don't know if this will be a permanent change, right? Generally, America goes on. I mean, by some counts, we have one mass shooting in this country every single day. This one got a lot of attention, but it'll fade away until, the next time. And, of course, I mean, the ironic thing is that in the aftermath of these, politicians always say, now is not the time to discuss this, right? Now is not the time to politicize this. Well, it makes me wonder, when can we discuss this? Right. Is it now time to discuss the Las Vegas shooting? Has enough time passed that we can talk about that one, for example? I don't know.
The feeling, I think, in this shooting, what is different as well is that, some have made, let's just say, made fun of that reaction enough that it's not being used anymore. We can't talk about it now because we're mourning. And then, when the mourning's done, this has faded from the headlines. Dave, what do you feel about that in terms of how this reaction, and it has been different, is different, and is it a distinction without a difference? Difference without a distinction, whichever way that goes.
I think this one is different because the students of the school have become very active, and they've kind of allowed this to remain in the headlines and have kept the story moving forward. But unfortunately, it's likely to fade. Mm-hmm. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be talking about something else. And the minor progress that is made, like in Florida, the legislature is discussing gun legislation. To my knowledge, they haven't actually passed anything yet. But as the story recedes from the headlines, the pressure will recede off the politicians. And the likely scenario is that we won't really see any substantive difference.
Well, what about the point that Jonathan just made? And I'm looking at this morning consult, a political poll, showing in detail. Here's one point. 53% of Republicans indicated in this poll they support stricter gun laws. Now, compare that to 37% of Republicans in this same poll following that Pulse nightclub shooting in 2016. Perhaps some change there that is of significance. We'll see. Let's talk a little bit about the leadership provided by President Trump on this issue. Here he is speaking to a room full of governors at the White House this past Monday about his proposals for dealing with gun violence.
By the way, bump stocks, we're writing that out. I'm writing that out myself. I don't care if Congress does it or not. I'm writing it out myself, okay? You put it into the machine gun category, which is what it is. It becomes essentially a machine gun, and nobody's going to be able. It's going to be very hard to get them. So we're writing out bump stocks. But we have to take steps to harden our schools so that they're less vulnerable to attack. This includes allowing well-trained and certified school personnel to carry concealed firearm. At some point, you need volume. Now, I don't know that a school's going to be able to hire 100 security guards that are armed. Plus, I got to watch some deputy sheriffs performing this weekend. They weren't exactly Medal of Honor winners, all right? The way they performed was, frankly, disgusting. They were listening to what was going on. The one in particular, he was early. Then you had three others that probably a similar deal a little bit later, but a similar kind of a thing. I really believe you don't know until you test it, but I think I really believe I'd run in there even if I didn't have a weapon. And I think most of the people in this room would have done that too, because I know most of you. But the way they performed was really a disgrace.
Okay, the president maintaining he would have perhaps run into the school without a weapon to confront the shooter. Jonathan, you first. The president's leadership here, his comments?
I mean, Will's comments are very silly, right? This is a man who got 5 deferments from Vietnam and called avoiding STDs, quote, his own personal Vietnam. I don't think that, you know, there's been any indication in any of his personal past that he is a particularly brave individual. I mean, I'm not saying that I would have run in, right? But I'm also not claiming live on TV that I would have done so. I mean, this, you know, it's a silly point. I mean, you know, and but sort of picking up on the failure of law enforcement in this, I mean, it's, you know, the NRA and other groups say that only a good guy with a gun will stop a bad guy with a gun. Well, in this case, this Florida school had a good guy with a gun, and it didn't stop the bad guy with the gun. I mean, I don't know how we can mandate that people be brave in these situations, right? I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, Trump's leadership on this is, he's tied to the Republican Party, and there's only so much he can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dave, there's also the aspect of President Trump. He has the habit, often repeated, of stating his views, then changing them very quickly. How does this impact his leadership on this issue?
It's very commonplace now that he comes out very strongly with a position. In this case, he says he absolutely is going to ban bump stocks, whether Congress does it or not. He's coming for the bump stocks because he recognizes that it turns a legal firearm into an illegal firearm by giving it the ability to fire automatically. But I think what we've learned with President Trump's leadership so far is that you have to wait to see if he actually does it. And I have seen no movement for him to actually do anything against bump stocks yet. He's very strong on rhetoric. I think he is one of the strongest rhetorical presidents we've had. But the follow through just doesn't seem to be there.
Mm-hmm. 2 weeks after the school shooting in Florida that killed 17 people, we heard in our top of the hour news that Dick's Sporting Goods, this is one of the largest chains of its kind in the U.S., it said today that it's ending sales of all assault-style rifles and that it would not sell any gun to those under 21 years of age, regardless of the local laws. So this is one of the strongest stances taken by corporate America. We saw the past few days, we saw Delta Airlines, among more than a dozen companies that have severed ties with the National Rifle Association since that shooting. We also coupled with that in reaction Monday, the lieutenant governor in Georgia threatened to kill a lucrative tax cut for Delta Airlines after that action by Delta. So, Jonathan, you first. What are your thoughts on this new facet, on why we're seeing corporations react now when they really haven't in the past, have they?
Generally not. You know, I think a lot of it is probably social media, right, that these corporations are sort of getting direct pressure from people in a way that they hadn't gotten before. And there's, you know, because in a certain sense also the national climate has changed, at least for now, as a result of this shooting, right? I mean, CEOs are people too, and, you know, some of them are saying, wait a minute, probably there's something we can do about this. And so there does seem to be some corporate movement. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how long it lasts. It also, of course, puts these corporations in a very difficult position, right? I mean, and so, you know, Delta Corporation in Georgia, as you mentioned, is potentially facing, you know, a real financial loss from the state because of the way they do their politics. And this is more and more corporations, I think, are going to get squeezed on this issue. And we'll have to see what happens. It's hard to predict.
Mm-hmm. Dave, do you see any political impact that these corporate moves make on our political landscape?
I'm waiting to see if there is any political movement, but I don't think there will be. I think companies are reacting right now because there is a pervasive feeling in America that something has to be done, and our government has totally failed at this. John brought up the Morning Consult poll that has a majority of Republicans in favor of some kind of gun control. Well, that's new, but for years now, 90% of the public has been in support of universal background checks. When people heard about bump stocks, there was near universal support for banning bump stocks. Public opinion has been for gun control for a very long time. There is just a small, very committed wing of the Republican Party that resists it. And the NRA is just a behemoth in terms of a powerful interest group. And they will not allow Republican politicians to get on board with any kind of gun control. So any movement is probably going to come from the people themselves and their votes, or from companies just saying, we can't endorse this anymore.
Join our conversation, Dave Anderson and Jonathan Hasid, two political scientists at Iowa State University, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Oskaloosa. Reggie is listening in Oskaloosa. Welcome to the program, Reggie. What point do you want to make?
I wanted to make the point that right now the background system we have that was actually created by the NRA is a failure, not due to the NRA, but due to the states for failure to report. More than, it's like 38 states report less than 80% of the people that should be on the list.
Mm-hmm.
The military failed to report 5,000 people that should have been on the list, which would have kept the Texas shooter from getting a gun. And he was actually stopped by a NRA member with an AR-15. So let's start with fixing the system that's in place now instead of just creating more laws that the only people will affect are people that don't break the laws.
Mm. Okay. Your view out of Oskaloosa, what about this idea of that's often brought up, Dave, that we have laws, they're not being carried out?
Well, I think Reggie brings up a good point, and in part, I think he's right. We do need to better enforce the laws. But that doesn't mean that we can't talk about other laws to create. I mean, the fact is that we're talking about this right now because of a mass shooting. We are the only country in the world outside of Sudan and Yemen that has mass shootings like this. And we're not even having a conversation, a real conversation as a country, as to what would stop mass shootings. And background checks are a great thing to implement, but the background check system has been systematically hampered by one political party. And if we're going to get serious, I think, yes, we do need to enforce the laws that are on the books. But we should also be talking about how do we prevent these atrocities from happening. And I, for one, don't think that full gun control is going to solve everything. I think there's a lot of research that says banning guns just is not feasible in the United States. But we need to have a conversation about what can be done. And the whole point of a legislature, a democratic legislature, and that small d democracy, is to talk about our problems and come up with solutions. And right now, our political leaders have just ducked this issue for 20 years.
We are in a midterm election year. So, Jonathan, what do you think? Does this shooting and the aftermath, the student protest, does this firmly embed this as a major theme in our upcoming election season?
You know, probably not. Memories are short, and it's, of course, only February. So by the time November rolls around, there'll probably be other two or three other mass shootings in the meantime, at least, and that get a lot of headlines. And, you know, I suspect that the people who are you know, there seems to be a lot of anger and political mobilization on the side of the Democrats now. And, of course, most of the people who are supporting firmer gun control are Democrats already. So it's sort of hard to disentangle this effect. But it may well be that these people would have been motivated to vote anyway and will, you know, do so for their favorite politician. I don't know that it'll drive up turnout or maybe, you know, become a major issue that has any impact on voters.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on now. Perhaps we'll come back to the gun issue with callers. Or other developments, but let's look at this other development from yesterday. Jared Kushner stripped of his top secret security clearance. This is the president's son-in-law, also senior advisor. He'd been operating on an interim clearance for months because of delays in his FBI background check. Now, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly is overhauling the clearance process. If you remember a few weeks ago, a top aide accused of spousal abuse to resigned. That was last month. So, Dave, your thoughts on what's going on here? This was a bombshell for the White House to deal with. Jared Kushner, I mean, you have to ask, how effective can Jared Kushner be when he doesn't have top security clearance?
Well, with Jared Kushner, it's kind of a difficult conversation because there's a question about how effective he was from the beginning. Any other president who had dared to nominate their son-in-law, who was very young, I think he's 36, has no diplomatic experience, no experience in government or foreign relations, and is really just the heir to a wealthy real estate fortune. Nominating him to run foreign policy largely out of the White House was a bold move. It would have been considered scandalous in almost any other administration. And the fact that he failed to properly disclose all his foreign contacts repeatedly on his disclosure forms set up more red flags. And here we are over a year into the administration, and suddenly the administration has to admit that he's just not entitled to a security clearance. that is going to hamper his ability to work with foreign nations. It means he doesn't have access to what we know about foreign nations. And if you're going to negotiate, it's really nice to know what the other nation wants and what they're willing to give up, so you have an advantage going into the room. And at this point, Jared Kushner just doesn't have that.
You mentioned red flags. Dave, let me turn to you, Jonathan. Evidently also green flags in this picture of colorful flags, green flags for certain countries. We also have the reports that certain countries, I think Mexico, Israel, other countries looking to take advantage of Jared Kushner's relative lack of experience here.
I mean, it's not surprising. One of the countries that was mentioned in this report who was looking to sort of use leverage on Jared Kushner was China. And of course, there have been, at least in the past, financial ties between various Chinese companies and the Kushner Corporation. So, for example, right after the inauguration, the Kushner company was in ties with a major Chinese insurer named Anbang to buy the very troubled debt that underpins his investment in 666 Fifth Avenue in New York. And the Chinese actually pulled out. Anbang, incidentally, has since been seized by the Chinese government as bankrupt, so it's probably for the best for the Kushner companies that that didn't happen. But there have been efforts before, at least on the Chinese side, to sort of, I think, to use financial ties to try to make more influential, to get access to the White House and Jared Kushner's influence. So this isn't the first time that this sort of thing has come out. And we'll have to see how eliminating his security clearance changes things. It may well be that other countries no longer see him as quite so worth influencing if he doesn't have this kind of top-level clearance.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if either of you have seen any reaction from the president about his son-in-law being downgraded in his security. It seems like, based on past experience, this might set off a Twitter storm at some point.
I would wait for 6 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay. We're gonna come back in just a minute. Quick word, Billy Graham died. A quick word on his significance, his body in state the evangelical laying in honor in the rotunda. Either of you want to reflect quickly on Billy Graham's passing, the role he played in several administrations?
Yeah, he was a pivotal figure for a very long time in American politics, and I think helped bring social conservatives to the Republican Party, and really gave social conservatism a voice in American politics for a very long time.
Right, and going back to advising even President Carter, am I remembering right?
I mean, President Nixon as well.
President Nixon as well. Okay, going back several decades, Billy Graham laying to be honored in the rotunda in our nation's capital. We'll come back in just a moment with Jonathan Haseeb and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University in the political science department. Still to come, we'll talk about more developments in the Russia probe. Also, we want to talk about state politics as well. So going abroad also to China a little bit more. Changes there, perhaps back to one-man rule. And when we talk about China, we want to talk about North Korea as well. We'll be back in just a moment. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dave Anderson and Jonathan Haseeb. Back after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Happy to have Jonathan Haseeb and Dave Anderson on board of Iowa State University. They're on the faculty of the Political Science Department there. Love to have you join our conversation as we talk in this next half hour about the latest developments in the Russia probe. Also want to talk a bit about China, North Korea, and some state politics as well. Let's start off with, well, we have so many strands, as typical of every week on Politics Day, of the Russia probe. Let me throw out a few of these strands, and the two of you can sort of weave them together and make a tapestry for us that perhaps we can understand going forward. We'll see if we're doing that in the dark or not. Well, evidently, cooperating with Special Counsel Robert Mueller has its advantages. Yesterday, Mueller asked a federal court to dismiss a series of criminal charges against former campaign deputy Rick Gates. These are charges that included tax and banks fraud in exchange for his guilty plea. This was the plea deal announced last Friday. He's giving testimony into the wider probe of the 2016 presidential election. And but Dave, let me start with you. Weave a little bit and tell us what that tapestry looks like now that we know of a few more threads.
Well, the investigation is always kind of a search for truth, and they're trying to find out what is really the biggest law that has been broken by the biggest player in America. And Rick Gates started off as a rather big fish. He was a large name in the Trump campaign early on. When he and Paul Manafort were indicted, that raised a lot of eyebrows across America, because this is the first time, to my knowledge, that we've had a presidential campaign manager and a deputy arrested for some pretty serious charges. And they both said they were not guilty. But now that Gates has changed his tune and has pled, the only way he gets a plea bargain agreed to by the prosecutor is if he has given up material information that will advance the investigation against a bigger fish or against bigger charges. Mm-hmm. And that could be against Paul Manafort, but it seems like Paul Manafort was already pretty – there's a lot of evidence against him right now is right. The indication. So there's another question about, well, where's the investigation going to turn next? It has uncovered a lot so far about a lot of players within the Trump campaign, and there's the big question of how high can it go?
Of course, this is rooted in firmly established intelligence from all of our intelligence agencies that the Russians meddled in our 2016 campaign. We are not the first country they have done that to. They have done that regularly to European countries, Eastern European countries, the meddling. But Jonathan, let me throw this your way. The National Security Agency Director, this is the top U.S. intelligence official, yesterday, Mike Rogers, told lawmakers he has not received a specific direction from the Trump administration to disrupt Russian cyber attacks targeting U.S. elections. Yes, this is an election year. Here he is speaking with the Democrat Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island. He's an Armed Services Committee ranking member.
Have you been directed to do so, given the strategic threat that faces the United States and the significant consequences you recognize already?
No, I have not, but if I could flesh this out, I'll say something in an open, unclassified. I'd be glad to go into more details.
Yes, sir.
In a classified. Based on the authority that I have as a commander, I have directed the National Mission Force to begin some specific work. I'd rather not publicly go into that, right, using the authorities that I retain as a commander in this mission space.
So as inherent ability of a commander to prepare, plan,
yes, sir,
and structure, but you need the direct authority of the president through the Secretary of Defense.
To do some specific things.
Specific authority.
There are some things I have the authority, and I am acting within that authority now, waiting.
But we have not taken on the Russians yet. We're watching them intrude in our elections, spread misinformation, become more sophisticated, try to achieve strategic objectives that you have recognized, and we're just essentially sitting back and waiting.
I don't know if I would characterize it as we're sitting back and waiting, but I will say it's probably, and again, I apologize, I don't want to get into the classified here. It's probably fair to say that we have not opted to engage in some of the same behaviors that we are seeing.
Okay. So Jonathan, tell me what you hear in that snippet of conversation between our U.S. Top U.S. intelligence official, Mike Rogers, and the Democratic Senator Jack Reed.
Certainly the optics of it are strange, right? I mean, the Trump administration, over and over again, President Trump has said the Russia investigation is a hoax, there's no Russia problem. So it's not clear why he's unwilling to push back against the Russians. Of course, he famously disclosed a lot of classified information right in the Oval Office to the Russian ambassador. And, you know, even if the man has nothing to hide, it's odd that he's acting like this. It also politically looks weird, right, for the administration, when all of the intelligence services are saying this is a real threat, for President Trump to sort of dismiss this whole thing as a giant hoax. I don't know if it's because he feels personally threatened or he thinks that people use it as a political weapon against him. But certainly he doesn't seem to be going after these obvious Russian intrusion attempts in the way that many in the intelligence community would like him to do.
Mm-hmm. just today, President Trump issuing a rebuke to the Attorney General. This is a tweet from today. Dave, comment on this. The president publicly chastising Jeff Sessions over an investigation into the alleged surveillance abuses. Let me just read the tweet of the president verbatim. Why is AG Jeff Sessions asking the Inspector General to investigate potentially massive FISA abuse? Will take forever, has no prosecutorial power, and already late with reports on Comey, etc. Continuing, isn't the IG an Obama guy? Why not use Justice Department lawyers? All caps, disgraceful.
Yes.
I don't know if I had a chance, if you caught that before the show.
I did catch that, and it is very Trumpian. It is the president going after his attorney general for not—
His own guy.
His own appointed attorney general for essentially not beginning a political investigation. The inspector general's office is there to prevent politics from intervening. And they conduct nonpartisan investigations to make sure that government employees are behaving appropriately. And that's exactly the procedures that we want to see followed. Mm-hmm. You don't want to see the Department of Justice, under the direction of a political appointee, leading investigations into other political actors because it feels partisan. It decreases trust in the system. We want it to go to a nonpartisan person.
Okay. Another thread in this, perhaps you have several that I won't get to today, but yesterday, Hope Hicks, this is a close aide to the president, declining to answer questions about the administration from members of the U.S. House of Representatives Intelligence Committee investigating the 2016 U.S. election. Remember, there are three investigations, Senate, House, and the special counsel. This is in the House. Hicks is the White House Communications Director. She was Trump's spokeswoman during the 2016 campaign. President seeming to defend her shortly before her House appearance yesterday, early yesterday, saying, of course, witch hunt, a phrase he's used often in the past, as Jonathan, you pointed out here. Did we learn anything from, well, it was 9 hours of testimony, and we heard about it from some things about it from people who were there. It wasn't broadcast or anything, was it, Jonathan?
It was not. And apparently she refused to answer any questions, many questions about the transition period, so after Trump was elected, but before he was inaugurated, and any questions after his inauguration. And she did this without invoking executive privilege, which is very strange. There's no legal basis for her. Bannon, incidentally, Steve Bannon did exactly the same thing. He refused to answer questions about these periods without invoking executive privilege. And normally this would set up a confrontation between the executive and legislative branches, right? The legislative branch in Congress and the House and the Senate have their own ability to subpoena, have their own ability to compel testimony. But generally we don't see this kind of fighting that happens within parties. And so for now, you know, the GOP in the House in particular has stepped back from trying to pressure both Bannon and Hope Hicks to talk. We'll have to see if that changes. Apparently there seems to be some momentum for trying to get Bannon back and to compel his testimony via subpoena and to force him to try to answer things that he's legally required to answer but has so far not done.
Mm-hmm. Hope Hicks, the White House Communications Director, after 9 hours of testimony, one of the interesting headlines that made it out, she acknowledged that she has occasionally told, in her words, white lies for the president, but has not lied about anything relevant to the Russia investigation. Anything to add to the commentary, Dave, to what Jonathan said?
Well, that's just a very curious way to say, to describe her own behavior, to say, well, yes, I have lied, but I won't actually talk to you about how I've lied or what I've lied about, because I'm not going to talk about anything I did in the transition or in the administration, but I can tell you that I've lied about some things. I don't know how to react to that. It means that you are not very trustworthy, and you also won't tell us what you're being untrustworthy about. This should raise red flags for everybody, and it's quite amazing to see members of Congress listen to testimony like this and not all walk out furious. The Democratic members walked out furious because they wanted answers to questions. But it seems like a lot of the Republicans walked out of the room. And these are largely the same Republicans who were irate against Hillary Clinton for years and years in investigations. But they walked out of this room and said, well, that's okay. You don't have to answer our questions.
Mm-hmm. Dave Anderson with us, along with Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University. Another 10 or so minutes of Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Wanted to go abroad and then come right back home to our state legislature. Let's go abroad to China and Southeast Asia, North Korea. Jonathan, this is a specialty of yours, special interest of yours in research. Explain to us President Xi Jinping's elimination of term limits in China, or was actually the Communist Party of China making a change, but at his behest?
That's right, yes. So he has eliminated term limits, which of course means that he is now free to serve as many terms as he like. He also, in this last session, had so-called Xi Jinping thought written into the Chinese state constitution. There are two different Chinese constitutions. There's the constitution of the Communist Party, where he was written in last fall, and now he's been written in as the importance of Xi Jinping thought has been written into the state constitution.
What does that mean, the importance of Xi Jinping thought?
Well, it's mostly a symbolic thing. So every Chinese leader up until now has had their thoughts enshrined in one or another of these documents. This is the first time since Mao that a particular leader's thought has been enshrined in the state constitution. And so it's a symbol of preeminence. It's a symbol that Xi is trying to sort of take over this kind of Maoist preeminent supreme leader role. In my opinion, it's actually a disaster for China. I mean, since the reform era, so the reform era began in the late 1970s, around 1978. Since the reform era, the two big rules for elite levels of Chinese politics have been that decisions have been made collectively and that there should be an orderly leadership transition. Xi Jinping has thrown out both of these rules, and he's done so at a time where China's facing increasing challenges. So the Chinese economy is slowing down, especially compared to just 3 or 4 years ago. It's really slowed way down. There seems to be, increasing risk of things like capital flight. There's a big debt problem. And so Xi Jinping is taking on all of these things in this enormous country onto himself just at the time when things are starting to go sour. It's a very strange move, I think, for him to make. And in the long run, it's going to be really bad for China because it means that there are no more rules at the elite level of politics. If someone wants to get rid of Xi Jinping, they have to either coup him or wait for him to die, and it's going to create a lot of pressure among other elites.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like getting rid of term limits is something now China has in common with Russia. What might this mean, Jonathan, quickly, for U.S.-China relations, anything? I mean, we have our former governor, spoke with him on this program not too many days ago, now Ambassador Branstad in Beijing, leading that huge embassy there. What might this mean for U.S.-China relations? Anything that you can see?
Yeah, I think it'll get more conflictual. I think now that Xi has really consolidated power domestically, he's going to do things like stepping up the artificial island building in the South China Sea, which the Chinese have been doing a lot of. I suspect that especially in response to so the Trump administration has proposed putting tariffs on various Chinese goods, like solar panels, for instance. And I suspect that Xi Jinping, now that he feels really secure, will be able to step up with, equally hard restrictions on the Chinese side. And so we may be in for rocky times ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay, before we get to state politics, I want to continue with you, Jonathan, on North Korea. While we're in the neighborhood of China, let's talk about North Korea. Monday, the president criticizing his predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, for their handling of the North Korean threat. Let's listen to some of his remarks.
I think that President Xi is unique. He's helping us with North Korea, who, by the way, wants to talk. As of last night, you heard that. They want to talk. And we want to talk also only under the right conditions. Otherwise, we're not talking. They've been talking for 25 years. Other presidents should have solved this problem long before I got here. And they've been talking for 25 years. And you know what happened? Nothing. The Clinton administration spent billions and billions of dollars. They gave them billions. They built things for them. They went out of their way, and the day after the agreement was signed, they continued with nuclear research. It was horrible. The Bush administration did nothing, both. The Obama administration wanted to do something. He told me it's the single biggest problem that this country has. But they didn't do anything. And it would have been much easier in those days than it is now. I think most people understand that.
Okay, certainly unconventional, but we do have a president who does everything, it seems, unconventional to criticize so directly. Your predecessors, also of the same party, Jonathan, but react to the president's characterization of his predecessor's dealings with North Korea.
I mean, he's not wrong. You know, all of the previous approaches to North Korea have failed, but the previous presidents failed to solve the North Korea problem because it's not a solvable problem. I mean, essentially, the North Korean regime wants to stay in power and the U.S. wants to get rid of, you know, the Kim regime. And so this is really the fundamental disagreement. And, you know, so Trump has talked about giving North Korea a bloody nose and so forth. I mean, that would lead to the deaths of tens of thousands of people. Essentially, there are no palatable options, right? All of the options are bad. Going to war is probably the worst option because it'll result in the I mean, there are 37,000 American troops in South Korea. And, of course, there are millions of South Koreans who live within range of North Korean artillery, who many of whom would die in the opening stages of a conflict. Sanctions haven't worked. The idea that China can somehow pressure North Korea into giving up their nuclear program is more or less a fantasy. The Chinese and the North Koreans, although they're supposedly allies, they don't get along at all. They actually hate each other. And so, I mean, previous presidents haven't solved this because it's probably not solvable.
Okay. So how does this, I won't say solving it, how does this play out in your view? Or what are the ways in which you see it possibly playing out? Because we have been made very aware of the timeline of North Korea advancing with its missile technology, its nuclear warhead technology.
I mean, I think probably a continuation of the status quo is the best that we can hope for. That is to say, North and South Korea are still technically in a state of war after the signing of the armistice, after the Korean War. The war never technically ended. And so if we can just keep this war from ever getting hot again, I suspect that's sort of the best we can do. And of course, you know, the U.S. and the international community will have to try to work to stop North Korea's proliferating nuclear weapons. Apparently, they've been giving chemical weapons to Syria. So, you know, to the extent that that can be stopped, the international community needs to try to do that. But I don't know. I think this is a sort of a disease you can just quarantine. You can't cure.
Okay. The final few minutes with you, Dave, on our state government. Here's Republican Senator Randy Feenstra. He chairs the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee discussing the Senate Republicans' bill that would provide more than a billion, this is with a B, $1 billion in annual tax relief last week. Here he is.
The new tax plan is the boldest tax plan that's ever been done in the history of Iowa. It cuts our current income tax by 22%. It gives virtually every Iowan that makes $40,000 to $45,000 more a $1,000 reduction in their taxes. It completely rewrites our codes, completely simplifying how Iowa does the tax. Right now we have the most complicated system in the nation, and we're changing that to make it one of the easiest systems to do in the nation. We want to work with hardworking Iowans and make sure that they're keeping more money in their pockets.
Okay, Dave, comment on this. This is a proposal that's existing alongside debate over harsh budget cuts because of revenue shortfalls in the current budget, right?
Yeah, it is really hard to figure out how this tax cut figures into existing Iowan reality. The last 2 years, we've had budget shortfalls mid-year leading to sudden and rather unexpected cuts to the state budget, meaning that Iowa is simply not raising the kind of tax revenue we need in order to fund government the way the legislature has decided to spend money.
But the rationale here is quickly, the GOP rationale here is tax cuts will make Iowa more inviting to business?
That's the rationale, but those are pretty words. Other states have tried this, and in zero of those states, has it worked. And to put this in context, $1 billion a year tax cut goes into a $7 billion budget. That's 15%. Tell me any family that can currently have trouble making ends meet and then say, we're going to get rid of 15% of our income, and that's going to solve our problem. The expectations for business growth are just unrealistic. It may produce some economic growth and some business growth, but the amount of growth that would be necessary to offset a $1 billion cut is just stunning. And you have to remember, this is also following on the heels of a massive federal tax cut. So across the country, people are going to be experiencing more money in their paychecks from a very large federal tax cut.
Democrats, of course, warning that this could force huge spending cutbacks, education, health care, other government service cutbacks.
Yes, and that is absolutely inevitable. And with the Iowa budget, it just is very difficult to see where this tax cut is going to be paid for. The kind of cuts that would be necessary sound just unrealistic. Things like, well, we could close the public higher education system, just close the University of Iowa, Iowa State, Northern Iowa, and that would not meet the shortfall. We still wouldn't close the budget gap. So
we're talking about big numbers.
We're talking about enormous numbers, and the idea that this tax cut, at least so far, has not been coupled with any discussion of where the cuts are going to come from. Just makes it very unrealistic at this point.
The hour has come to a close. Dave Anderson, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, I want to thank you very much for coming into our AIM studio to share the hour with us and your insights. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you
for having us.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Ben Stanton, along with Lindsay Moon. Natalia Reyes helped out today as well. Tomorrow on the program, retired Iowa Judge Douglas Russell. He's the author of two books about Sir Winston Churchill. We'll get his view on Darkest Hour. That's this film nominated for 6 Oscars about Winston Churchill. Back tomorrow with that. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.